So one of the impressions you grew up with about the Royal Navy was impressment into service, and particularly in obviously the coastal towns. Was that really the case, and people that are pressed into service?
Yes. Again, you see, one of the fundamental things which underpins the Royal Navy in this period is that ships have a relatively long life. So once you've built a warship, you can keep it going for 60 years. And this will come back to this when we talk about profound changes later on, when you can't do that in 1900. We'll come back to that later. So in peacetime, of course, these great warships were simply put into what is called in ordinary. I mean, they were put into storage. So the Royal Navy didn't run these great warships during peacetime. They were just in harbour at ease. So the Royal Navy manpower in peacetime was pretty small. Of course, once war started, then the government was by law allowed to impress sailors, impress people in the ports. And there were, in fact, quotas. Each port had a quota of X thousand men who could be impressed for service in the Navy. So the Royal Navy's manpower skyrockets suddenly in wartime. And yes, obviously merchant sailors were then forced into the Royal Navy. They didn't like it because the pay was not so good. And of course, the freedom of action was constricted. Again, you have flogging and so on and so forth. Discipline is harsh, but the impressment does work. Now, of course, the upside of that, in a way, if there is an upside, is that unlike the army, where a man, once he joins the army, if it were, or joins a regiment, he's there for life, essentially, certainly for 20 years, in the Navy, you are only impressed for the service when that ship is in active service. And so once the ship comes back to port and is, as it were, taken out of active service, the ship's company is dismissed. Of course, that means it's hard in terms of livelihood if you're unemployed immediately. But on the other hand, it's great for freedom if you basically want to get back to being a fisherman or a merchant seaman, as it were. But it is a very curious kind of setup. But once you're impressed, then as long as that ship is in active service, you stay with that ship. So the problem was, of course, in 1793, 94, people might have thought the war would be short. They didn't know it was going to go on essentially for nearly 20 years, with a break in 1803 to 1805. But the system was peculiar in that sense. The men, however, were obviously specialists. You would have men assigned to particular big battleship, a big warship, would have three main masts, and they were many, many sails at different heights going up pretty high. So you'd have men assigned to particular masts, and of course by age and strength, different levels of the mast. And so the youngest and nimblest would be assigned to the very top, which is a hell of a long way up, and so on. And again, other men, of course, would be assigned to guns and so on. So there's quite a strict hierarchy of skills and training and so on. So men would know exactly where they were supposed to be on the ship and would be, if you like, specialists in those areas and so on. But I think the key, you were saying earlier about experience, the key, of course, was that the more the Royal Navy is at sea blockading, the more skilled the men become in the tasks that they face. Unlike the French, who are mainly bottled up in harbour. They don't have that seaworthiness. In tactical terms, the British did develop a variety of tactics, and I suppose the two things which are distinctive in this period are the idea that instead of getting alongside an opponent's ship and firing your guns against the side of the enemy ship, you should try to get behind the enemy ship. So you fire your guns into the stern, as it's called, the back of the enemy ship. The advantage of that, of course, is that the enemy can't fire at you, because he's got very few guns in the stern. And if your ship passes the stern of the enemy ship, the guns fire as they go across the stern of the enemy ship. And that means that you fire a very large amount of shot into the stern, into the back of the enemy ship. Those cannonballs roll the whole length of the enemy ship, so they have more destructive impact than if you fire a cannonball into the side, they just go across it. So they've got all these cannonballs rolling all the way down the length of the enemy ship, causing mayhem among his crew and his guns. So that's the first tactical thing which the British do develop. as a new tactic. So instead of lining up side by side and firing away at each other, you try to get to the stern of the enemy vessel. Now, if you do that, of course, it means that what you try to do is, if you think about it, in the classical, traditional form of naval battle, if you had, say, 20 vessels, 20 ships of the line, battleships, you'd line them up all in a row and come up against the enemy's 20 ships. So number one ship in your line would try to line up with number one ship in the enemy's line. And you'd blast away at each other in what are called broadsides. Of course, that was, in a sense, an even duel. If, however, you decide to go for the sterns, what you tend to do, and this is what Nelson was particularly famous for at Trafalgar, but the British had used this before the Trafalgar, was you have your vessels arranged in two lines and you cut across the enemy line. You kind of form a T with the enemy line sailing, if you like, north-south, and you sail east-west. And if you have two lines of your ships, obviously you create more damage. And so you actually break down the enemy's line and you have complete chaos in the battle. But you are trying to get your ships behind selected enemy ships and to destroy them. So that's the kind of tactical innovation the British were coming up with. They tried it before 1793, they tried it in 1780s. So it's not something which is associated distinctly with Nelson, but Nelson certainly perfects it. The second thing is, where do you aim your guns? And one kind of objective might be to try to fire at an enemy ship to knock down their masts, to disable them. And so the enemy ship just becomes a kind of floating hulk. It can't control its manoeuvres, it can't control where it's going, and so on. The British tended, by using this tactic of firing into the stern, to prioritise that, not firing into the masts. And so basically they are trying to kill the enemy's sailors, all these cannonballs rolling down the whole length of an enemy vessel will kill sailors, destroy guns, rather than to cripple the enemy's capacity to sail. And this again is distinctive, it's man-killing rather than ship-destroying. And so you are incapacitating the enemy's vessel by taking out his manpower. And you can see the effectiveness in the battle numbers. If you look at Trafalgar, for example, the British lose relatively few sailors. The enemy losses are very much, very, very much higher because of his firing into the hulk of the vessel itself. So in those ways, yes, there are tactical changes going on here. But of course, it does require a good deal of daring to do what the British were trying to do. Because as you sail towards the enemy fleet in line, the enemy can fire at you, but you can't fire at him because he's got all his guns pointing at you, but you've only got the bows of your ships heading towards him. So it does require a good deal of patience. And at Trafalgar, for example, the British fleet advanced towards the Franco-Spanish fleet, basically a little more than walking pace, because the wind is very light when the battle starts. And so you're sitting on your vessels, you know, dawdling along, and you can see these 30-odd enemy vessels who can fire at you, and you've got to wait until you get up close to them before you can fire back. So it's very testing, and it takes hours and hours before the British at Trafalgar get to the Franco-Spanish line, and it must have been pretty tense time and so on. Individual ships would have bands. Depends on the wealth of the captain of a ship. He would employ perhaps a dozen musicians, so they might be playing stirring music, as it were, keep you happy. But you just had to sit and wait. You couldn't do very much, waiting for the battle to commence.